not to make big money by cherry-picking the healthiest. Political parties existed to organize and inform voters, not to corrupt our democracy with giant campaign contributions and negative ads. Over time, these institutions and their leaders seem to have forgotten that their legitimacy depends on them advancing the common good, and that leadership is a public trust. Trusteeship should be baked into our understanding of successful leadership. Political victories that undermine trust in politics shouldn't be considered victories. They're net losses for society. Record corporate profits achieved by eroding the public's trust in business aren't successes. They're derelictions of duty. Lobbying and campaign donations that result in laws and regulations favoring the lobbyists and donors aren't triumphs if they weaken public confidence in our democracy. They, too, are abject failures of leadership. But how can leaders buck the pressures to do whatever it takes to win when not doing so allows their political or economic competitors to prevail and puts them out of a job? This has become the standard justification for whatever it takes leadership. Yet it's based on a fallacy. It assumes that the backers who put such people into positions of leadership, voters, investors, members of various organizations, intend for them to do whatever it takes to win. Many of these backers, however, do not want leaders to do whatever it takes because they understand their own obligations to the common good and how such strategies harm everyone over the longer term. True leaders must help more people to understand this. One example. On the eve of the Senate's final vote on repealing the Affordable Care Act in July 2017, Senator John McCain returned to Washington from his home in Arizona, where he was being treated for brain cancer, to cast the deciding vote against repeal. But that was not the most important thing he did. He took to the Senate floor to condemn the whatever-it-takes politics that had overtaken Washington. McCain began by saluting a former generation of senators for whom the common good was more important than winning any particular legislative contest. "I've known and admired men and women in the Senate who played much more than a small role in our history, true statesmen, giants of American politics," he said. "They came from both parties and from various backgrounds. Their ambitions were frequently in conflict. They held different views on the issues of the day, and they often had very serious disagreements about how best to serve the national interest. But they knew that however sharp and heartfelt their disputes, however keen their ambitions, they had an obligation to work collaboratively to ensure the Senate discharged its constitutional responsibilities effectively. That principled mindset and the service of our predecessors who possessed it come to mind when I hear the Senate referred to as the world's greatest deliberative body." McCain then admonished his present colleagues for eroding the common good, with words aimed as much at voters as at the senators. "Our deliberations today are more partisan, more tribal, more of the time than any other time I remember," he said. He reminded them that winning was not as important as upholding and strengthening the institutions of governing. "Our system doesn't depend on our nobility. It accounts for our imperfections and gives an order to our individual strivings that has helped make ours the most powerful and prosperous society on earth. It is our responsibility to preserve that, even when it requires us to do something less satisfying than winning. Even when we must give a little to get a little. Even when our efforts manage just 3 yards in a cloud of dust, while critics on both sides denounce us for timidity, for our failure to triumph." This wasn't the first time McCain refused to pander to the worst in current American politics, even though pandering might have been an easier path to victory. One of my fondest memories of McCain occurred in the 2008 presidential campaign at a town hall event in Minnesota, when he responded to a supporter who said he was scared at the prospect of an Obama presidency. "I have to tell you," McCain said, "Senator Obama is a decent person, and a person you don't have to be scared of as president of the United States." At this, the Republican crowd booed. "Come on, John," one audience member yelled out. Others shouted that Obama was a liar and a terrorist. A woman holding a microphone said, "I can't trust Obama. I've read about him, and he's an Arab. He's not..." At that moment, McCain snapped the microphone from her hand and replied, "No, ma'am. He's a decent family man and citizen that I just happen to have disagreements with on fundamental issues, and that's what this campaign's all about. He's not an Arab." Our best chance of reversing whatever it takes politics is through political leaders like John McCain, who demand that politicians attend to the common good rather than win by undermining it, and who help educate the public about the importance of doing exactly this. This is the essence of political leadership. In 2017, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake demonstrated similar leadership. What is it about Arizona? When he castigated his fellow Republicans for their failure to stand up to Trump. To carry on, "As if what was happening was anything approaching normalcy, required a determined suspension of critical faculties and tremendous powers of denial," Flake wrote. "If by 2017 the conservative bargain was to go along for the very bumpy ride because with congressional hegemony and the White House, we had the numbers to achieve some long-held policy goals, even as we put at risk our institutions and our values, then it was a very real question whether any such policy victories wouldn't be Pyrrhic ones." Flake reminded Americans that politics must be about strengthening the institutions of self-government. He went on, "If this was our Faustian bargain, then it was not worth it. If ultimately our principles were so malleable as to no longer be principles, then what was the point of political victories in the first place?" Flake warned that conservatives had taken the institutions of government for granted. "As we have engaged in one of the more reckless periods of politics in our history. In 2017, we seem to have lost our appreciation for just how hard-won and vulnerable those institutions are." I don't want to suggest it's only been Republicans who have admonished their leaders over whatever it takes politics. In October 2015, during the Democrats' primary debate, Virginia Senator Jim Webb was asked how, if he were elected president, he would govern differently from Barack Obama. Webb said the difference would be the use of executive authority. Webb said he objected to Obama's tendency to make laws through executive orders. The practice hurt our system of government. "I came up as a committee counsel in the Congress, used to put dozens of bills through the House floor every year as a committee counsel," Webb said. "I have very strong feelings about how our federal system works and how we need to lead and energize the congressional process instead of allowing these divisions to continue to paralyze what we're doing. So I would lead, working with both parties in the Congress and working through them in the traditional way that our Constitution is set." Whatever it takes politics comes at a huge cost to the common good. That cost is often hidden. McCain, Flake, and Webb brought some of it into the light. An American president is not just the chief executive of the United States, and the office he, eventually she, holds is not just a bully pulpit to advance certain policy ideas. He is also a moral leader, and the office is a moral pulpit invested with meaning about the common good. It's hardly the case that every president has been a moral exemplar. But a president inevitably helps set the moral tone of the nation. The values a president enunciates and demonstrates ricochet through society, strengthening or undermining the common good. As one of George Washington's biographers, Douglas Southall Freeman, explained, Washington believed he had been entrusted with something of immense intrinsic worth, and that his duty was to uphold it for its own sake and over the long term. Even by June 1775, when Congress appointed him to command the nation's army, Washington had already, quote, become a moral rallying post, the embodiment of the purpose, the patience, and the determination necessary for the triumph of the revolutionary cause. He had retained the support of Congress and won that of New England in like manner and measure by directness, by deference, and by manifest dedication to duty, end quote. Washington exemplified a duty to the cause of the Constitution and liberty. He led by moral example. Some 240 years later, in the 2016 presidential campaign, candidate Donald Trump was accused of failing to pay his income taxes. His response was, "That makes me smart." Although not yet president, his comment conveyed a message to millions of other Americans that paying taxes in full is not an obligation of citizenship. As I pointed out, Trump also boasted about giving money to politicians so they would do whatever he wanted. "When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. And they're there for me." In other words, it's perfectly okay for business leaders to pay off politicians, regardless of the effect on our democracy. Trump sent another message by refusing to reveal his tax returns during the campaign, or even when he took office, or to put his businesses into a blind trust to avoid conflicts of interest, and by his overt willingness to make money off his presidency by having foreign diplomats stay at his Washington hotel and promoting his various golf clubs. These were not just ethical lapses. They directly undermined the common good by reducing the public's trust in the office of the president. As the New York Times editorial board put it in June 2017, quote, "For Mr. Trump and his circle, what matters is not what's right, but what you can get away with. In his White House, if you're avoiding the appearance of impropriety, you're not pushing the boundaries hard enough. Government ethics officials say dealing with this administration is an exhausting game of whack-a-mole. Go after one potential violation and two others crop up. That's because ethical regulations were not written with this sort of administration in mind," end quote. A president's most fundamental responsibility is to uphold and protect our system of government. Trump has weakened that system. When, as a presidential nominee, he said that a particular federal judge shouldn't be hearing a case against him because the judge's parents were Mexican, Trump did more than insult a member of the judiciary. He attacked the impartiality of America's legal system. When Trump threatened to loosen federal libel laws so he could sue news organizations that were critical of him, and later to revoke the licenses of networks critical of him, he wasn't just bullying the media. He was threatening the freedom and integrity of the press. When, as president, he equated neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klan members with counter-demonstrators in Charlottesville, Virginia, by blaming both sides for the violence, he wasn't being neutral. He was condoning white supremacists, thereby undermining equal rights. When he pardoned Joe Arpaio, the former sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona, for a criminal contempt conviction, he wasn't just signaling it's okay for the police to engage in brutal violations of civil rights. He was also subverting the rule of law by impairing the judiciary's power to force public officials to abide by court decisions. When he criticized NFL players for kneeling during the national anthem, he wasn't just asking that they demonstrate their patriotism. He was disrespecting their, and indirectly everyone's, freedom of speech. In all these ways, Trump undermined core values of our democracy. Steve Kerr, coach of the NBA's Golden State Warriors, responded to Trump's attack on the NFL players by using Kerr's own position of authority to reframe what the players were doing. "Just think about what those players are protesting," said Kerr. "They're protesting excessive police violence and racial inequality. Those are really good things to fight against. And they're doing it in a non-violent way, which is everything that Martin Luther King preached, right? A lot of American military members will tell you that the right to free speech is exactly what they fight for. And it's just really, really upsetting that the leader of our country is calling for these players to be fired." Kerr went on to urge Trump to use his moral authority as president to unite rather than divide. The fact is, we live in an amazing country, but it's a flawed one. I consider myself unbelievably lucky to live here, so please spare me the if-you-don't-like-it-you-can-get-out argument. I love living here. I love my country. I just think it's important to recognize that we as a nation are far from perfect, and it's our responsibility to try to make it better. And one of the ways to do that is to promote awareness and understanding and acceptance. Not just acceptance, but embracing our diversity, which, when you get down to it, is not only who we are, but truly what makes us great. And it's not happening. Remember, the president works for us, not vice versa. We elected him. He doesn't just work for his constituents and his base. He works for every citizen. Once you take that office, you have to do what's best for the entire country. Sure, you're going to have policies that align with your party, but that's not the point. Respectfully, Mr. Trump, the point is this. You're the president. You represent all of us. Don't divide us. Bring us together. The mere fact that someone has become president of the United States itself lends his views public legitimacy. A team of economists led by Leonardo Burstyn of the University of Chicago showed that Trump's harangues against immigrants during the 2016 presidential election helped legitimize anti-immigrant bigotry. 2 weeks before the election, Burstyn and his colleagues recruited 458 people from 8 states where Trump was leading. Half were told Trump would definitely win. The other half got no information about Trump's projected victory. The researchers then asked each of them whether they would authorize the researchers to donate $1 to a group called the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which the researchers described, accurately, as an anti-immigrant organization whose founder wants European Americans to remain the majority in the United States. Half were assured their decision would be anonymous. The other half assumed it could become public. For those who were not informed about Trump's expected victory in their state, donating to the anti-immigration group was far more attractive when their anonymity was assured than when they thought they might be exposed. 54% authorized the donation if secret, 34% if it might go public. But among participants who were told Trump would win, half authorized the donation, regardless of anonymity. While many Americans harbored anti-immigrant feelings before Trump, they kept those feelings to themselves. Perhaps they didn't even allow them to rise to full consciousness. That's because such sentiments were assumed to be wrong, to violate the common good. But Trump's election legitimized those sentiments because it suggested that millions of others shared them. After Trump, bigotry became more acceptable. So did bashing political opponents, even after an election is over. Before Trump, the peaceful transfer of power was assumed to be a central feature of our democracy. As Harvard political scientist Archon Fung has noted, when losing candidates congratulate winners and deliver gracious concession speeches, they demonstrate their commitment to the democratic system over any specific outcomes they fought to achieve. That demonstration is an important means of reestablishing civility. Think of Al Gore's gracious concession speech to George W. Bush in 2000, after 5 weeks of a bitterly contested election, and just one day after the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in favor of Bush. "I say to President-elect Bush that what remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country. Neither he nor I anticipated this long and difficult road. Certainly neither of us wanted it to happen. Yet it came, and now it is ended, resolved as it must be resolved through the honored institutions of our democracy. Now the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken. Let there be no doubt, while I strongly disagree with the court's decision, I accept it. And tonight, for the sake of our unity as a people and the strength of our democracy, I offer my concession." Bush's response was no less gracious. Vice President Gore and I put our hearts and hopes into our campaigns. We both gave it our all. We shared similar emotions. I understand how difficult this moment must be for Vice President Gore and his family. He has a distinguished record of service to our country as a congressman, a senator, and as vice president. This evening, I received a gracious call from the vice president. We agreed to meet early next week in Washington, and we agreed to do our best to heal our country after this hard-fought contest. Americans share hopes and goals and values far more important than any political disagreements. Republicans want the best for our nation, and so do Democrats. Our votes may differ, but not our hopes. Many voters continued to doubt the legitimacy of Bush's victory, but there was no civil war. Think of what might have occurred if Gore had bitterly accused Bush of winning fraudulently and blamed the five Republican appointees on the Supreme Court for siding with Bush for partisan reasons. Think what might have happened if, during his campaign, Bush had promised to put Gore in jail for various improprieties, and then, after he won, accused Gore, or Bill Clinton, of spying on him during the campaign and trying to use the FBI and CIA to bring about his downfall. These statements, close to ones that Donald Trump actually made, might have imperiled the political stability of the nation. They would have sacrificed the common good to an extreme form of whatever-it-takes politics. Instead, Gore and Bush made the same moral choice their predecessors had made at the end of every previous American presidential election, and for the same reason. They understood that the peaceful transition of power confirmed the nation's commitment to the Constitution, which was far more important than their own losses or wins. It was a matter of public morality. Trump had no such concern. This is the essence of Trump's failure of trusteeship. Not that he has chosen one set of policies over another, or has divided rather than united Americans, or even that he has behaved in childish and vindictive ways, unbecoming a president. It's that he has sacrificed the processes and institutions of American democracy to achieve his goals. By saying and doing whatever it takes to win, he has abused the trust we place in a president to preserve and protect the nation's capacity for self-government. CEOs and directors of major corporations are also entrusted with the common good. It is no excuse for them to argue they have no choice but to do whatever it takes to maximize share prices. No law requires them to do this. As I've shown, the idea that the sole purpose of a corporation is to maximize share prices is relatively new, dating back to the 1980s. The dominant view for decades before had been that corporations are responsible to all their stakeholders. In the summer of 2014, the managers, employees, and customers of a New England chain of supermarkets called Market Basket joined together to oppose the board of directors' decision earlier that year to oust the chain's popular chief executive, Arthur T. Demoulas. Their demonstrations and boycotts emptied most of the chain's 70 stores. What had been special about Arthur T., as he was known, was his approach to business. He kept prices lower than his competitors, paid his employees more, and gave them and his managers more authority to make decisions. Just before he was ousted, he offered customers an additional 4% discount, arguing they could make better use of the money than the shareholders could. Arthur T. viewed Market Basket as a joint enterprise from which everyone should benefit, not just its shareholders, which was why the board fired him. Yet eventually, consumers and employees won. The boycott was so costly that the board sold the company to Arthur T. CEOs of big corporations might say Market Basket doesn't apply to them because it's not a publicly held company whose shares are traded on major stock exchanges. Market Basket doesn't have to worry about failing to maximize share prices and thereby succumb to corporate raiders or activist investors. True, but this doesn't let CEOs of publicly traded companies off the hook. Arthur T's business model could be applied even where many shareholders are involved. Patagonia, a large apparel manufacturer based in Ventura, California, for example, has organized itself as a benefit corporation, a for-profit company whose articles of incorporation require that it take into account the interests of workers, the community, and the environment, as well as shareholders. Benefit corporations are certified, and their performance is regularly reviewed by nonprofit third-party entities, such as B Lab. By 2017, 31 states had enacted laws allowing companies to incorporate in this way, thereby giving CEOs and directors explicit legal authority to consider the interest of all stakeholders. CEOs might still argue that if they want to raise money in public capital markets, they have to attend solely to the interests of shareholders, or else competitive forces will wipe them out. That argument makes it sound as if CEOs are powerless to change this. But recall that markets are based on rules, and human beings create those rules. Remember also that CEOs of large companies have outsized political influence over what those rules are. CEOs who understand leadership as trusteeship could use their outsized political influence to push for laws that resurrect stakeholder capitalism, requiring CEOs to consider all their stakeholders, giving workers greater voice in management decisions, as in Germany, requiring companies to make severance payments to communities they abandon in order to compensate for the disruption, prohibiting mandatory arbitration in contracts with customers and employees, and limiting the tax deductibility of CEO pay. Why stop there? Why don't CEOs of big companies do whatever they can to make the economy work for everyone, rather than for a privileged few like themselves? Rather than reflexively seek tax cuts, they could push to raise taxes on corporations, as well as on people like themselves and other wealthy Americans, and dedicate the funds to better schools for all American kids. They could seek a higher minimum wage, bigger wage subsidies in the form of the earned income tax credit, better infrastructure, more portable pensions, universal health care, and other measures that would raise wages and make American workers more economically secure. Rather than fight for laws that make it harder for workers to unionize, they could fight for laws that make it easier. If this sounds far-fetched, that's only because of how far we've come from the era when the heads of American business viewed themselves as corporate statesmen with responsibilities for the common good. In the 1940s and 1950s, CEOs of major corporations like General Motors, Coca-Cola, and Eastman Kodak joined together in the Committee for Economic Development to lobby for measures to expand jobs. They even argued that unions serve the common good. In the 1960s, many of these CEOs lobbied for stronger environmental protections and for passage of the Environmental Protection Act. As I've noted, most Americans now believe the system is rigged in favor of big corporations and Wall Street. And in many respects, it is. But nothing is stopping CEOs and top executives on Wall Street from putting an end to the rigging. They could reduce the needs of candidates to raise vast sums of campaign money by supporting public financing of campaigns. They could back stricter limits on the revolving door between industry and government personnel, and laws requiring full disclosure of the sources of all campaign funding. Why shouldn't CEOs and top Wall Street executives be in the vanguard of seeking a constitutional amendment allowing lawmakers to limit lobbying and campaign spending? The answer is nothing is stopping them, except their own parched, self-serving notion of leadership as maximizing profits and shareholder value, whatever it takes. But as leaders of institutions with the greatest influence over American politics, they also have a duty to the common good and are uniquely positioned to advance it. For too long, they've abdicated this responsibility. We're now living with the consequences. They can see these consequences as readily as you can, if they're willing to look. None of this is simply a matter of ethics. Ethics involves fulfilling legal responsibilities, avoiding obvious conflicts of interest, and behaving in an above-board manner, as now routinely taught in graduate schools of business, and as required for obtaining many professional licenses. Ethics is about how to avoid legal troubles or public relations disasters. Leadership as trusteeship extends way beyond ethics. It goes to the heart of the job. It requires a different way of thinking about the central obligation of leading any institution. Part of the responsibility of elected or appointed government officials, of corporate executives, and of leaders of nonprofits and other major organizations in society must be to enhance the public's trust in their institutions and in our political economic system as a whole. Their success should not be measured solely in how much money they or their organizations make or raise, how much power they accumulate, or how much influence they wield. They must also be judged by the legacy of trust they pass onward. As Shimon Peres, a former prime minister and president of Israel, put it in his memoir, "We need a generation that sees leadership as a noble cause, defined not by personal ambition, but by morality and a call to service." Exactly. The purpose of leadership is not simply to win. It is to serve. Chapter 8. Honor and Shame. Societies traditionally enforce the common good through honor and shame, honoring those who make exemplary contributions to it and shaming those who exploit it for personal gain. Can we do so again? Ideally, children learn about honor and shame at an early age by watching and hearing parents, teachers, mentors, and religious leaders. Adults help a young child develop a moral consciousness through how they live their lives, whom they admire and respect, and whose behavior they disdain. Some of these lessons are also conveyed by one generation to the next in morality tales, the Bible or other sacred texts, histories, and prominent biographies, and fictionalized stories of heroism and treachery. Other lessons are embedded in popular culture, songs, movies, biographies, and the daily news. As I've said, a president of the United States has a special role because he or she is a living embodiment of honor or shame. These lessons establish and reconfirm the common good. Not as propaganda, but as the expression of a society's values. Tribal cultures live by honor and shame. These sentiments also play a large role in certain Asian societies. Since the founding of the United States, as I've noted, religious communities have informed people's understandings of what they owe to one another as participants in the same community. These influences can be powerful because one of humankind's deepest needs is to belong. Through most of human history, survival has depended on extended families, clans, and tribes. To be highly respected has meant strong support from the group. Historically, to be ostracized has often meant death. Modern America seems to have misplaced honor and shame. We often honor people who haven't advanced the common good, but have merely achieved notoriety or celebrity or amassed great wealth or power. We shame people not for having exploited the common good for personal gain, but for failing to conform to prevailing ideas about fashion or coolness or for associating with the wrong people. If we're to revive the common good, we must use honor and shame appropriately, bringing public attention to virtuous behavior and public condemnation to behavior that erodes public trust. Doing this, of course, can be tricky. If shame is to be meaningful, average people must retain their capacity to be offended by actions that undermine the common good. If they tip over into cynicism or become numbed to such behavior, they may no longer see it as particularly shameful. The behavior becomes normalized. It's also the case that people who have shown utter contempt for the common good are often the least capable of feeling shame. They're literally shameless. During his trial for criminal fraud, Martin Shkreli ridiculed prosecutors. After his conviction, he smirked. By the same token, some of the most truly honorable people in society don't seek honors. Their modesty and humility often make them nearly invisible. They credit others and respect their craft or calling too much to think of themselves as exemplary or extraordinary. Hugh Hecklow relates a speech given by Chicago Cub Ryne Sandberg when he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 2005. "I was in awe every time I walked onto the field," Sandberg said. "That's respect. I was taught you never, ever disrespect your opponents or your teammates or your organization or your manager, and never, ever your uniform. Make a great play. Act like you've done it before. Get a big hit. Look for the third base coach and get ready to run the bases. Hit a home run. Put your head down. Drop the bat. Run around the bases. Because the name on the front is a lot more important than the name on the back." Sandberg credited others who had been inducted before him. "These guys sitting up here did not pave the way for the rest of us so that players could swing for the fences every time up and forget how to move a runner over to third. It's disrespectful to them, to you, and to the game of baseball that we all played growing up. Respect. A lot of people say this honor validates my career, but I didn't work hard for validation. I didn't play the game right because I saw reward at the end of the tunnel. I played it right because that's what you're supposed to do. Play it right and with respect. If this validates anything, it's that guys who taught me the game did what they were supposed to do. And I did what I was supposed to do." Honor and shame can be dangerous sentiments in the wrong hands or if used for the wrong purposes. Dictators and demagogues throughout history have bestowed honors on those loyal to them and sought to disgrace those with the courage to stand up to them. Public shaming can also carry a painful stigma. "Ignominy is universally acknowledged to be a worse punishment than death," wrote Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, who also sought to put an end to public stocks and whipping posts. 4 centuries ago, public shaming included scarlet A's. In the 1950s, Senator Joseph McCarthy destroyed reputations and careers by accusing people of being communists. These days, social media can unleash torrents of invective upon people who do little more than say something silly or insensitive, or who look different. It can cause a sensitive teenager to take his or her life. In contemporary America, the meaning of honor has become confused partly because those who bestow honors often have ulterior motives. Government funding has dried up for nonprofits, such as universities, hospitals, and museums. Funds for social services of churches and community groups are growing scarce. Appropriations for public television, the arts, museums, and libraries have been slashed. Research grants are waning. Legislatures are cutting back on university funding. Meanwhile, vast riches have been accumulating in the hands of a relative few. As a result of both trends, nonprofits have been using the lure of honors to hook rich donors. Presidents of universities, congregations, think tanks, and other nonprofits are now kissing the posteriors of wealthy donors as never before. Galas are held in their honor. Colleges bestow on them honorary degrees. Endowed professorships carry their names. They're awarded prizes and medals. Awards and prizes themselves are named in their honor. University buildings, concert halls, and museums are also named after them, their family names etched for eternity in granite or marble. In all these ways, their identities become synonymous with society's notions of honorability. Curiously, though, little or no attention is given to how these donors obtain their wealth. They may have violated or skirted laws, paid off politicians, engaged in insider trading or price fixing, defrauded investors, or even brought the world economy to near ruin because of their disregard for the consequences of their schemes. These behaviors, though, are assumed to be irrelevant to the deal at hand. In return for their donation, they are imbued with moral approval. The subtle message is that the common good doesn't really count. Wealth and power do. The aforementioned Michael Milken was indicted in 1989 for racketeering and securities fraud. He pleaded guilty to securities and reported violations and was sentenced to 10 years in prison, subsequently reduced to a fine of $600 million and a permanent ban from the securities industry. In 2016, the very same man was honored with the Dr. Armand Hammer Philanthropy Award. I don't think prostate cancer research would be where it is today without Michael Milken, gushed former film studio executive Sherry Lansing at the award ceremony. He is the pioneer in this field, so I'm incredibly grateful to him in all areas of cancer research. He's extraordinarily generous. Milken's generosity was admirable, but bestowing a public honor on him required that the benefactors suspend any moral judgment about how his wealth had been obtained. It's an example of the intentional unawareness that conservative writer and former Education Secretary William Bennett had once warned about. Quote, "Non-judgmentalism has permeated our culture," he wrote, "encouraging a paralysis of the moral faculty," end quote. It would be one thing if Milken had publicly admitted that his fraudulent acts were wrong and then openly sought to redeem himself through philanthropy. At least then, the subsequent honors wouldn't seem so at odds with the common good. But to the contrary, he heaped praise on himself for what he did. In 2017, his webpage claimed that his, quote, "use of convertible bonds, preferred stock, high-yield bonds, collateralized loans, equity-linked instruments, securitized obligations and derivatives, among other instruments, helped create millions of jobs," leading a Time Bureau chief to write in 1997, "Milken was right in almost every sense," end quote. Sometimes these deals put their beneficiaries in the awkward position of having to defend the honor of philanthropists tainted by scandal. The Taubman Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government is named after Alfred Taubman, who in 1988 donated $15 million to establish it. In 2002, Taubman was sentenced to prison for orchestrating a price-fixing scheme between the nation's top two auction houses. After the conviction, Harvard students asked Harvard officials whether they would change the name of the center. The answer was no. The center's director explained that, quote, "In the great scheme of things, Taubman has led a very ethical life. His conviction does not mean that his life has not been ethical or one that Harvard doesn't want to associate with," end quote. Hello? Taubman had just been convicted of price fixing. His name was etched on Harvard's School of Government, which is supposed to train students to work for the common good. A criminal conviction for price fixing did not alter the appropriateness of honoring this man? At other times, such deals confer on donors a patina of respectability and social approval that obscures the donor's ongoing attacks on the common good. Consider David Koch, co-owner, with his brother Charles, of Koch Industries. In 2008, the New York City Ballet renamed its home at Lincoln Center the David H. Koch Theater after he donated $100 million to modernize it. The renaming acknowledges the extraordinary generosity of Mr. Koch, said a spokesperson for the ballet. To my knowledge, David Koch has broken no law, but his political activities have undoubtedly undermined the common good. I'm not talking about the Koch brothers' right-wing political views. People may differ in their opinions about taxes or the environment. It's that the Koch brothers' political spending has been so vast that it has made a mockery of the ideal of equal voting rights. As Charles Lewis, founder of the Center for Public Integrity, a nonpartisan watchdog group, told the New Yorker's Jane Mayer, "The Kochs are on a whole different level. There's no one else who has spent this much money. The sheer dimension of it is what sets them apart. They have a pattern of lawbreaking, political manipulation, and obfuscation. I've been in Washington since Watergate, and I've never seen anything like it. They are the Standard Oil of our times." Early in 2017, a spokesman for the Koch's political network said it planned to spend between $300 million and $400 million to influence politics and public policy during the first 2 years of the Trump administration. Public honors are similarly lavished on celebrities, people sufficiently well-known that the act of honoring them generates positive publicity for the institution and assures current and prospective donors of its importance. In return, the celebrity gets an honorary degree, or an embossed plaque, or sometimes even money, appropriately called an honorarium, for attending. In many instances, the celebrity is repaying a friend or business associate, say, a movie producer who happens to serve on the board of the conferring institution. The transaction is innocent enough. No overt harm is done. But in the process, the idea of honor is debased. The celebrity is already celebrated by definition. He or she is being honored for being celebrated, a tautology that displaces any intervening thought about the common good. Honors should matter, especially when they appear to convey social judgment. We automatically attach the prefix, the honorable, to the names of presidents, vice presidents, members of both houses of Congress, judges, and other people appointed to office nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, except for military officers. Once the title is conferred, the recipient keeps it for the remainder of her life. By some estimates, nearly 100,000 people in the United States are addressed as the honorable. I don't mean to sound priggish, but I don't see why members of Congress who have been convicted of taking bribes or embezzling money should continue to be referred to as the honorable. Nor, for that matter, any members who have been censured or reprimanded by their colleagues. Why should a cabinet member convicted of breaking the law while in office remain the honorable, even if he subsequently receives a presidential pardon? Why should a member of Congress who beats up a reporter for asking a question he doesn't like be referred to as the honorable? Their behavior was shameful. They've dishonored themselves and the offices they held in trust. Those who are honored should have shown the courage to stand up for the common good against the forces of greed, corruption, and abuse of power. I'm thinking of people like Cheryl Eckard, who in 2002, as a quality assurance manager at pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline, discovered serious problems at its largest plant, drugs produced in non-sterile environments, a water system contaminated with microorganisms, and medicines made in the wrong doses. After Eckard alerted management, she was fired. She then shared her findings with the Food and Drug Administration and sued the company. After an 8-year trial, GlaxoSmithKline agreed to pay the government $750 million for manufacturing and selling adulterated drug products. The court also ordered the firm to compensate Eckhart for her dismissal and the emotional harm it caused her. It's difficult to survive this financially, emotionally. You lose all your friends, because all your friends are people you have at work, Eckhart said afterward. You really do have to understand that it's a very difficult process, but very well worth it. We should also honor people like Army Major General Antonio Tacuba, who insisted on an honest investigation into the alleged torture of prisoners by the CIA and the U.S. Army at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, even though his military and political superiors didn't want one. From the moment a soldier enlists, we inculcate loyalty, duty, honor, integrity, and selfless service, said Tacuba. And yet when we get to the senior officer level, we forget these values. The fact is that we violated the laws of land warfare in Abu Ghraib. We violated the tenets of the Geneva Convention. We violated our own principles, and we violated the core of our military values. We should honor Eileen Foster, who in 2008, while in charge of fraud investigations at Countrywide Financial Corporation, the nation's largest subprime mortgage lender, at the epicenter of the mortgage meltdown that almost brought the entire economy to its knees, told her superiors that many executives in Countrywide's chain of command were working to cover up the massive fraud. A few months later, Countrywide's new owner, Bank of America, fired her for, quote, unprofessional conduct, end quote. Foster then began a 3-year fight to clear her name and prove she and other employees had been punished for doing the right thing. In 2010, the U.S. Department of Labor ruled that Bank of America had illegally fired her for exposing the fraud. I don't let people bully me, intimidate me, and coerce me, Foster told the Center for Public Integrity's I Watch News. And it's just not right that people don't know what happened here and how it happened. I'm also thinking about people who have quietly and modestly worked for the common good over long periods of time in ways that have made all of us better off or more secure. Public servants like Daniel Freed, to whom I referred earlier, who joined the Foreign Service in 1977 and served for 40 years. Freed rarely made the headlines. Instead, he quietly demonstrated the importance of steady diplomacy and patient engagement with the rest of the world. We should honor unsung heroes like John Minderman and Paul Magianis, the FBI agents who were on duty when they received word of a break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate complex in 1972. Years later, Minderman remembered Nixon's aides who tried to stonewall their investigation as gutless and completely self-serving. They lacked the ability to do the right thing. Minderman and Magianis had no doubt that the right thing was to bring that wrongdoing to light. As Magianis recounted to the New York Times, it was we, the FBI, who brought Richard Nixon down. We showed that our government can investigate itself. Let me add to the honor roll people who put themselves in harm's way for the good of all. First responders, volunteers in natural disasters, firefighters, police officers, members of the armed forces. We should also honor others who do just about the most difficult jobs of all, often in harrowing circumstances. Teachers in poor communities, social workers, nurses, elder care, and hospice workers. They are the true heroes of America. They keep the nation going. But they're often overlooked, sometimes even insulted. Most earn very little. Isn't it time we honor them? We can honor them with our respect and appreciation. We can honor them by making sure they earn enough money to live on. We can also honor them by raising public awareness of the importance of the work they do. We have Academy Awards for actors, directors, and screenwriters, Nobel Prizes in math and science, culinary awards for chefs, Olympic awards for athletes, Kennedy Center honors for the performing arts. Why not awards for upholding and strengthening the common good? A common good award for an outstanding whistleblower. A common good award for an exemplary civil servant. A common good award for the teacher or social worker whose quiet and modest work over the course of her career has dramatically improved other people's lives. A common good award for the nonprofit leader who has taken a courageous stand speaking truth to power. Why shouldn't universities confer honorary degrees on these unsung American heroes? Why doesn't the United States, as does Britain, issue honors to 1,000 citizens each year who have made significant contributions to the common good? Their purpose would be to continually remind us of what it means to work for the common good, to offer examples of civic behavior we want to encourage, and to raise public consciousness of what we owe each other as members of the same society. Such public honoring could be a corrective to what we now do, blindly and automatically bestow honors on rich philanthropists because they're rich, and celebrities because they're celebrated. Wielded appropriately, shame can also be a powerful motivator for the common good. It can illuminate the gap between the ideals we profess and the reality we tolerate, mobilizing us into action. Martin Luther King Jr. shamed the nation by making it impossible for white Americans outside the South to condemn segregation there, while at the same time tolerating discrimination all around them. As King told a crowd of 25,000 in Detroit in June 1963, 2 months before his historic speech in Washington, "We've got to come to see that the problem of racial injustice is a national problem. No community in this country can boast of clean hands in the area of brotherhood. Now, in the North, it's different in that it doesn't have the legal sanction that it has in the South. But it has its subtle and hidden forms, and it exists in three areas. In the area of employment discrimination, in the area of housing discrimination, and de facto segregation in the public schools. And we must come to see that de facto segregation in the North is just as injurious as the actual segregation in the South. And so, if you want to help us in Alabama and Mississippi and all over the South, do all that you can to get rid of the problem here." By extending the shame of Southern segregation to the nation as a whole, King raised the bar. We were all implicated in racial discrimination. Racial segregation was the North's shame as well as the South's. It continues to be. Another version of this sort of shaming occurred in 1954 when Joseph Welch, then chief counsel for the U.S. Army, stood up to Senator Joseph McCarthy before a nationwide television audience. During a hearing in which McCarthy accused the Army of harboring communists, McCarthy attacked one of Welch's young assistants, Fred Fisher, for having once belonged to the National Lawyers Guild, which McCarthy considered a communist front. Welch responded, "Until this moment, Senator, I think I've never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness." As McCarthy renewed his attack on Fisher, Welch interrupted him. "Senator, may we not drop this? We know he belonged to the Lawyers Guild. Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?" McCarthy tried to make another point about Fisher, but Welch stopped him again. "I will not discuss this further with you. You have sat within 6 feet of me and could have asked me about Fred Fisher. you have seen fit to bring it out. And if there is a God in heaven, it will do neither you nor your cause any good. I